Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello. We have a conversation this evening that I think you will find inspiring, but also make you aware that everybody has their challenges in life, and the challenges can come from many different directions. My guest, Patricia Burns, has put out a book called Trish, and that is her nickname. This is her story, and I think you're going to find that her circumstances were a little bit unique. She is a mature lady who decided that she wanted to share her story, and maybe it could help somebody understand that no matter how rough the road is, one can still move forward, regardless of the circumstances. Patricia Burns, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Donna.
Patricia, you are a woman that has had a rather unique background as a child. You were born to a family that both of your parents were deaf. And yes, from as far back as you can remember, signing was a part of your life. And yes, this is something that not a lot of people do, and yet this is how your life began, was with yes, the signing. Tell us about your mom and dad and how it was that you ended up coming into this world.
You really want to know the truth?
Well, I think we got a pretty good idea about the basics, but what about your mom and dad?
Well, my mom and dad met each other at the New York School for the Deaf, and they graduated together, and they dated, and then my mom got pregnant and had to, they had to get married. My mom was typical of the school that they went to. It was like a trade school. The boys were taught, you know, certain mechanics, excuse me, and the girls were taught, to sew and cook and do all the domestic stuff. But my dad and mom were both very athletic. My mother particularly liked basketball, and my dad played the football. They were really very much in love, and I think they were very happy to get married. Too bad it didn't remain that way for years to come, because my dad was developing his alcoholism, and I think once he had one child, and then my sister was born 13 months later, I think being a dad and a husband was a bit overwhelming for him, and his drinking was pretty heavy, and I guess that's about it. I mean, as far as the summation of my parents, both my mom was Italian-American, of course. My dad was Irish-American, and they were like water and oil.
Mm-hmm.
My mom was, you know, fiery, not temperamental, but she did have a temper, and my dad was very passive until he drank, and he became a whole different person.
Mm-hmm. One of the things about your parents that I found was fascinating, neither one of them were born deaf. Your dad ended up with spinal meningitis, and your mom had some kind of a childhood illness. You weren't too clear on that, but it might have been measles, whatever it was.
Well, they, you know, my mother's parents were from Italy. They both spoke very little English in all the years that I knew them, and even though my grandmother wanted to learn to speak English, my grandfather did not. He was a bit of a tyrant, he was a tyrant. But they spoke limited English, and of course I could sign before I could talk.
Mm-hmm.
After I was born, and until my sister came along, you know, 13 months later, and I became the little speaker for my parents.
This is quite common. I have found, yeah. I'm from an Italian background, and I have very vivid memories of Italian immigrants, and often the women had a very difficult time adapting to speaking English. They would sort of have their own little communities, and
yes.
frequently the children, just like you, now you were using signing, but the children of the parents that came from the old country, as it often was stated, they were yes. very comfortable in both worlds. They would, I remember a little 4 or 5 year old boy translating for his mother everything that was being said, because yes. the father did not know how to do it. His English was limited. But there was that little youngster, and he was just going between them all. It was just so easy for him. I think that's mm-hmm. the way it is with children. They adapt very, very well.
Oh, yeah. And not only that, but whether your parents are from a different country and don't speak English, and my parents being deaf, the children involved have the same responsibilities to interpret for their parents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as I say in my book, I was a parentified child. My mom kind of trained me to do everything for her, and it wasn't abusive, but it also wasn't necessary. But she didn't know any better.
Well, you have to think of the times too, because
yeah.
it was a much different world. There was mm-hmm. not a world that had very much of a support system, unless you had mm-hmm. a lot of family, and then that may or may not be positive. But, mm-hmm. you know, being in the environment, being deaf, and at that yeah. time, women were looked down upon, and you bring that out in the book, that women were yeah. considered stupid, and that was part of your dad's problem. Not just the alcoholism, but he was caught in a web, if you will, just like your mother was. Even though they cared mm-hmm. a great deal for each other, they were forced to get married. And yeah. then it's like, okay, you're on your own, but this is what you've got to do. So all of these things evolving, and neither one of them really quite ready to face the big world as they
exactly.
had to face as adults.
Exactly. That's absolutely true.
So there you have that situation. And like you said, oil and water. Oh, my goodness. Irish yes. and Italian. Oh, boy. You got a great combination there.
Oh, I think that Italians and Irish make beautiful kids. You know, myself, I don't mean to refer to myself as beautiful, but I'm not hard to look at either. I keep having these brain freezes, but anyway, I don't know where I was going with that, but I do know that... I said earlier that I could speak sign language. I could sign before I could speak.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of enforced on me, so to speak.
Now, your grandmother was literally a prisoner in many ways.
Oh, yes.
Your grandfather.
Yes.
Now, your family actually lived in the same building that your grandparents lived in, but you were never invited to the family dinners that were held on Sunday.
That's correct.
That was
yes.
really strange.
Yeah,
your grandfather was horrible.
Yeah, I felt, my mother always felt left out, but she would hide her hurt feelings, and I knew as I got older, and all my aunts and uncles would come. They'd go to the local church, which was near us, and then they'd come over here and visit and have Sunday dinner.
mm-hmm. So,
but it didn't stop me from enjoying the aromas that came from my grandmother's apartment on the second floor. We were on the fourth floor.
Mm-hmm.
And
uh-huh.
I could smell all the cook, and I think I mentioned something in there about she used to make a big bowl of meatballs on Saturday. And I don't know how we didn't all get sick, because she put them in in the oven, not in the refrigerator, and they would sit there all night. And then she put them in the sauce the following day.
Mm-hmm.
My grandparents were, interestingly enough, they were both good cooks. And but that was hard, because I knew that it bothered my mother, but she wouldn't say anything about it.
A lot of your story is dealing with the ethnicities that and the time frame of difficulties in the era that you grew up in. And it gives us a window into how the role of the male and the female were portrayed, and yes, how there really was a significant challenge with alcoholism. And yes, this is something with women, usually they were closet alcoholics. With men, it just seemed that it was just there. And of course, there's that traditional attitude about the Irish that the yeah, women are just absolutely brilliant and have got constitutions of Godzilla, and yeah, that the men are all alcoholics. I can remember being told that years ago. And I yeah, go, what? So alcoholism isn't just with the Irish, but so often the men didn't have anything to do. They couldn't get yeah, good jobs. Here in the United States, there was tremendous discrimination against them. So whatever yes, they'd get, they'd go and they'd drink. And then
yes, indeed, yep,
the family would go hungry. All of this, yep, you know, was part of it. But you talk about going to parochial school, which I yep, know there's still some of those, but the parochial schools weren't really the best and nicest environments to be in, and they were extraordinarily strict, weren't they?
Oh, the nuns that, there were Dominican nuns that taught in the school that I went to, and of course it was a small school in upper Washington Heights, or I should say lower Washington Heights, because it was 163rd Street, and it was a small school, and everybody knew everybody else, and it was taught by Dominicans, as I said, and several of them were, one woman in particular, I think, had dementia. They were terrible to the kids, I remember when I went back to the church many years later after my fiancé died, and I told the priest that I met that, because I hadn't been to church in many, many years, and I told him the story. He says, you know, Pat, he said, they didn't know any better back then. I said, yeah, I know. And he said, it's easier to just forgive them and move on. And that's what I've done. But it's a different world today. The women who are religious have very different training, much smarter, and they're all college graduates. Back then, I think all the women, they went right into the convent after they finished high school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And some of them were really, one or two of them were good, but a couple of them had trouble with their hands, always slapping kids around. And it was not a good memory, you know, that made me very uncomfortable to go to school sometimes.
Well, I think that is common knowledge for a lot of people that
oh, yeah,
were in
oh, yeah,
that environment. And I think a lot of it had to do with frustration. Again, the times. This is something we need to remember. One of
yes,
the components in your story that's a very powerful component is about your grandpa, Durso. And there was the incest that evolved
yes,
because of him. And you thought for the longest time that what he was doing to you was your fault. Now, this is not
yes,
an unusual feeling for a child to have. And
yes,
he literally blackmailed you so that you wouldn't tell anybody. How long did this
right,
go on with your grandfather?
You know, to be honest with you, I don't know exactly how long. It started when I was 12, for about a year.
Mm-hmm.
A year to a year and a half, possibly. And then we got my mother applied for public housing, and we moved to Queens when I was 14.
Mm-hmm.
And by then, of course, I was fighting him back and telling him he couldn't do this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I just hated the way I felt.
Well, and
you know, I went for sexual abuse recovery. The best thing I ever did, because I learned so much about the feelings. All the feelings that I had were normal, and I finally tried it. I was 50 years old by the time I went into incest recovery, and realizing that all along I took the blame for it when it wasn't my fault.
Mm-hmm.
It was not my fault. You know, people have no, you know, it's a very intricate and very psychologically different situation from anything else when it comes to incest or sexual abuse of a young child, because kids feel powerless, especially if the person is your relative and is supposed to be the head of the family.
Yes. I think that that is something that is very poignant and very significant about your story, is how eventually you were able to tell your sons, and, I mean, you know, they were adults when you told them about what had happened to you by the member of your family, your grandfather. And mm-hmm. then you also talked to your sister, and she said he had abused her, too.
Yeah, imagine all those years, neither one of us told the other.
Just, you know, it's...
Because we both thought we were the only ones.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's what he did to make sure that you stayed...
Exactly.
...where you were, or where he exactly. could dominate you, and that is... really, really significant. You have a very dear friend that you talk about, Claire. And
she was actually my cousin.
Oh, she's your cousin. I beg your pardon. Okay.
Yeah, she was my mother's sister's child.
And she was of mixed race, and she was just a lovely person. But you make a comment, and again, these are the times that she was taught to be ashamed of who she was. And you had been put into a different set of circumstances, but you also had felt very badly about who you were as a person. You didn't you didn't like yourself at all.
No.
And dear Claire, you stayed in touch with each other, and sadly she ended up getting involved with not alcohol, but with drugs. And with you, you followed a patterning of alcohol. It's like someone said to me once, a lot of people that are addicted to something, they're doing it to release the pain. They don't want any more pain. And that's what I felt when I was reading your story.
Yes. That's why, you know, alcohol, for me, made all that pain go away. Unfortunately, you know, you start getting less and less tolerance for a little bit. And, of course, a true alcoholic will tell you, I'm not saying there's such thing as a false alcoholic, but someone who is an alcoholic will tell you, wow, one drink is great, so 10 must be better.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just something that you really, once I started, I couldn't stop.
Mm-hmm.
And it was... I never thought of it as a disease because it was, I thought it was a matter of and I said alcoholics, the people who were down in the Bowery bums, they were alcoholics. I didn't even believe my father was.
Mm-hmm.
I knew he had a problem drinking, but then when I started learning about alcoholism, I learned a tremendous amount of good facts that are important. You know, I believed my father drank too much, but I was going to do it better. And it's a genetic illness as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, chances are if you have one or two parents, you have a 50% or 100% chance of being an alcoholic.
This
and not everybody does,
mm-hmm.
but the only way you know is if you find out through your pattern of drinking. So,
your sister Barbara, she passed away in 2013, and the two of you were so close. You made the statement in your book, you'd never known a day without her. And
yes, that's true.
But she had her challenges too.
Mm-hmm.
When your dad died, when your mom died, did you have a feeling of relief when they passed? Were you able to make a sense of harmony at the time when they left this world?
My mother was only 49, and I was 28 years old when she died. And it was such a shock because it was sudden.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she had health issues over the years that she overcame remarkably. But I was so overwhelmed with my mother's death, I didn't even know how to deal with it. And it wasn't until my son Eric, I use a different name in the book. My son Edward was born a year later. And that's when the whole world came crashing down on me. I don't identify with a sense of relief when my parents died. They died, at, I guess, about 15 years apart. But in one sense, I was relieved when my dad died, but it was too soon. He was only 61. I really wanted to see my parents grow old a little bit, but it never happened.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, somebody told me the other day it could be a gift, because aging parents are a big responsibility. So, anyway, God had his or her reasons for allowing this to happen. So,
when you were writing this book, Patricia, when you were putting everything down in black and white to be able maybe to assist someone that may feel like when they're going through the dark nights of the soul, I think of young women that are unwed mothers today. The world is so different for them. They're not, they're not thrown out on the street typically. That can still happen, but generally there's a support system that is there. And it wasn't there when your mother and father were forced to get married. And,
no, not at all.
And with you, it was, you were, what, 17 when you had your first child? And it was the same, sort of a similar scenario as to your mother and father. And that was something, too, that you were forced to get married. So, this, you know, you think of the difference in the world today where young women, if they get pregnant, you know, that they're not looked down upon as the filth of the earth, because if they want to go to school and take care of the baby, they can do that.
Yes.
But that
yes.
wasn't possible then.
Mm-mm, not at all. No, my father wouldn't even. I would have, being as progressive as I was at 17, I would have been happy not to marry the guy, but my father insisted. He says, "You're not going. You have to marry." And of course, I go into detail about how he encourages the kids to marry me.
Oh yes, he didn't have a shotgun, but the encouragement was still there.
Yes,
you know that
big time.
That was very, very much the scenario.
Yes.
I mean, girls were many times they were taken if the they didn't want to marry the boy, or if the parents said you're just not going to have this child, they were taken to various states that had abortions, or they did alley abortions. I mean, it was really the history in the past is really a very sad history. So it's something to be able to read your story, because you were born in 1936, and what you have seen in the way of changes when you were putting this book together, putting it down in black and white, how did it affect you as you were going through all of these segments of your life and the experiences that you went through?
Well, the answer to that is it took me 10 years to write it. There were times when it was too painful, and I'd have to put the book away. And it was very hard to recapture the whole thing, and yet there was something very cathartic about it, too. I always felt I wanted the world to know my life story, simply because I just feel that I do believe in the premise, like they taught us in the sexual abuse recovery group, that the more you talk about something, the less it binds you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you're only as sick as your secrets, and that's a common expression in 12-step recovery, but it really is. It was hard to write the book, and parts of it were not hard, but the majority of it was. That's why it took me so darn long to write it.
Well, and I think that that is a very honest, an honest answer. When we will talk about many things that caused us a great deal of pain, most of the people that you have talked about in your book that were very close to you are gone. So you don't feel like you're violating any of their privacy. And at this time in your life, you're saying, I want people to know the story. I want them to know that they can have a good life. I want them to know that they can make their own decisions. And that was something that when I was reading your story, Patricia, when I was reading Trish, I thought, this is so relevant to be able to see where people have been, the time frames that they're in, and we have to be aware of those time frames because the thinking, the social dispositioning was totally, totally different from what we have today.
Yeah.
And it really makes it tough.
Well, one of the big motivations for my writing the book is because I wrote it when I was sober and abstaining in another fellowship, and I felt like it was important for me to tell people, you know, if I can do it, you can do it too.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, writing a book that projects recovery and hope and survival is very important because I that's what I want to share with people. You know, it was all kind of crappy up until a certain point, and then my life got turned around when I went into recovery. It's just, and of course, my late fiancé was a big, wonderful experience in my life. Unfortunately, he died suddenly, and as a matter of fact, I just lost my 32-year-old grandson in October. Of all the deaths that I've had to go through, this has got to be the worst.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he wasn't sick. He wasn't, it's just horrible. That's all I can say, to have your grandchild die before you.
Well, I think what it is, too, it's a story about life. And nobody, we have no guarantees. And death is going to touch us in so many different ways. And it is a reality. We all have an expiration date. And this is something where, you know, your statement about your grandson being only 32 years old, and it's like, gee whiz, he could have had his whole life, and here I am, a mature woman. How is it that he would be gone at that young an age? I don't know that we ever have all of the answers to that kind of a situation. But the reality is, you keep moving on. You've got other members of family, you have your own interests, and that is what we need to keep in mind, is that we can have dominion over our lives.
And I do enjoy my life, and there's a big hole in it right now, but I know that I will move on and enjoy my life, and continue to enjoy my life, and to after having worked for so many years, and to enjoy retirement. It's a beautiful thing, I have to tell you.
I think that's true. Now, Trish, your book, you have used your real name. Trish is a nickname for you. It's Patricia Burns, and that's B-Y-R-N-E-S. And people can find your book on Amazon. It's, the title, again, is Trish. And you can also find it on Modern History Press, as well as LovingHealingPress.com.
Correct.
So all of that is available. I want to thank you, Patricia, for being my guest.
Well, thank you for asking me. I appreciate that.
Well, and congratulations to you for writing, even though it took you 10 years for writing your story, because you never know whose life it's going to touch.
Exactly. So thank you so much, Donna.
It has been a joy. Check out Patricia Byrnes, B-Y-R-N-E-S. You can find her book at Amazon, Modern History Press, and LovingHealingPress.com. Donna Sebo here, and the phone line is open, 253-582-5597. And we are going to be taking a break, so stay with me, please, and I'll be right back with you. The Donna Sebo Show is heard weekdays, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. Callers are welcome to call in during the second half of the program at 253-582-5597. Please note that the announcement is made at the bottom of the hour if I'm not in studio able to take phone calls. Warriors for Peace is heard every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. For current information regarding my email newsletter, programming, and appearances, go to DelphiInternational.com. For information on publications, including my award-winning children's books, audiobooks, and more, go to Mrs. Sebo's Classics.com. This is Donna Sebo. If you or someone you know is an author and would like to be interviewed on The Donna Sebo Show or Warriors for Peace, please send a copy of the publication along with contact information, phone number, email, and website to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. That's The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review. Thank you. Sophia Goebel, Book Restoration Unveiled, is going to be my guest tomorrow evening. I am so looking forward to this conversation because I actually have some old books and I've thought, gee whiz, where do I go to get them fixed? You will, if you're like me, a fan of the Antiques Roadshow. Sometimes they have people that have old books that they have brought on and they evaluate them. And it's always fascinating to watch that program and the series of programs that have been produced. And what we find is that there really is a technique to restoring materials. Well, Sophia is making it public. She's been in the restoration of books for a good 25 to 30 years. So we're going to be hearing her story, and I'm really looking forward to it. Also, don't forget, today the newsletter came out. So you're going to be able to go to my website, DelphiInternational.com. The newsletter is going to be there with all of the illustrations. The newsletter I send out via email, and I have thousands of people on my email list, but when that goes out, because of the system I use, there's not a lot of photographs and things like that that goes with it. So just know you can always go to my website, and if for some reason the link's in the newsletter, I have something by John Denver in there, and there's a couple of other items that people have sent me that I included. So if it doesn't work on the one, come in to the website for the other. Also, just know that if you like us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter, my assistant Deb is going to keep you informed about the guests that are coming up. And there's a little bit of a write-up, and it gives you an idea, and she always shows the cover of the book as well. So we've got a great lineup, and this is an exciting month. Can you believe we're already through 2 months of the new year? Oh, my goodness. Unbelievable. And I was on the phone with someone in Alaska, and apparently the people in Alaska, they're busy, busy bees, and they're flying, and they're just doing all kinds of things. So I just think, wow, spring is here, and people are just absolutely antsy. They want to be out and about. So get out, get outside, enjoy the fresh air. Be out and, if nothing else, working in a garden, walk in one of your local parks, do something, but get yourself out of the house. And, of course, you're like me. When spring comes around, the first thing you notice are the windows. Right? Right. Every little bit of dirt shows, and the sun can't get through as brightly as it does when it's clean. So we're warming up, and that feels great. Tulips and daffodils are coming up through the ground here in the Pacific Northwest, and before we know it, they are going to be in full bloom. We have acres of tulips and daffodils here in the state of Washington that are just absolutely breathtakingly gorgeous to see. So within about 2 weeks, we're going to have them out in their full glory. So it's absolutely a wonderful time of the year. I wanted to share something that I came across. It was about friendship, and I really think friendship is so important. I'm so grateful for the friends that I have that have been in my life for many, many, many years. Even though we're in different parts of the United States, because of technology, we're able to keep in touch very, very easily. It's wonderful. So this is Friendship is a Blessing. It's by Emily Matthews. It's the best you have to share. The talents and the wisdom, the capacity to care. It's being there to lend support whatever needs arise. It's making sure that others know they're special in your eyes. Friendship is a blessing, and to all who have a friend, it's one of the most precious gifts that life could ever send. And I think that that is absolutely wonderful. And you know, when you have those friends, it seems like the bumps and grinds of life, the ups, downs, the roller coaster experiences that we go through, we're able to work with them a lot better because of those friends, and they're priceless. There's just no way that you can ever, ever put a price tag on a friend. You just can't. It's there, and it is wonderful. I wanted to share a thought with you. Now, if you want to give me a buzz and chat, 253-582-5597. Peter Madden was the chief executive of Forum for the Future, and I really liked some words that he had shared with people. And I thought I'd share them with you this evening, because here we are, and we're in the spring of the year. We have had a year with COVID that has just absolutely tossed everything into what I would say the blender of life, and it's just created all kinds of discord. But this is his attitude. He said, the future is a place of opportunity. The future is a place of opportunity where things can grow and prosper, where knowledge will spread and creativity and innovation should flourish. Yet, too many green visions are apocalyptic, doom-laden, and deterministic. Enough gloominess. We need to inspire and challenge people with positive stories of a sustainable future. Being green is not a break on progress, but synonymous with good economic sense and all the ingredients of a happy life. A sustainable future can be achieved. It's the only way business and communities will prosper. We need bold action now to make it happen. Boy, oh boy, bold action now. He wasn't talking about go out and smash things up. No, he was talking about let's work together. Let's come together in a way and manner that is going to empower the very environment that we're in. And I think working in a community, working together with people, is so significant. And you support each other, and it makes the rough times a little bit easier to handle. And I think that that quote is just absolutely right on. And instead of the doom and gloom, let's look at what we can do. Now, I will have to tell you, I feel so fortunate because of this radio show of the different people whose paths cross mine via the written word. Because I have a chance to travel to different parts of the world, hear stories about people's lives, and you know what? We get to bring it to you. You have the opportunity of listening to those stories, and I like to think that maybe you would be inspired by them. It is something that is so important. We need to know we're not alone. We are not the first person nor the last person to go through dark times. We're not the first person or the last person to know what success is like. In all of this, the more we can share and be open with what there is to share, the better it's going to be. It is going to make this world a lot healthier. It is going to make this world a lot more productive for the billions of people that are on this planet. And that is not a number that's shrinking. It's a number that's growing. So out of that, what are we having to do? We're having to learn how to work with agriculture differently. We're having to pay attention to the fact that there's too much trash that we're producing. How can we recycle that trash? What can we do in different parts of the world where there is such discord, where people don't even have a hope or a prayer of getting out of their environments unless they're especially innovative and willing to take high level of risk? There's all of these things that are a part of life. This is going on 24/7. It's nothing new to the human experience. But when you're living in that cubicle of life that you're experiencing, to break out of it, well, it takes guts. It really does. It really is something you have to say to yourself, I'm willing to take that risk. And that's not unlike my guest. She had to be willing to break patternings that were already present from the time she was a little girl. She had to break away from those patterns. It's not easy to do, but she did it. And her life is richer because of that. Well, I don't know about you, but my sweet tooth gets, well, it likes sweets. And I thought, what would be something this time of the year, spring? Well, peaches are not in, well, they're not coming out yet. However, you can always buy canned peaches. What about fixing a peach cobbler? And I have got a recipe here, and it is so easy to make. So if you're going to have some friends over, or if you just wanted to treat yourself, this is so easy to do. Now, you're going to need a 9 by 13 inch pan, and you're going to have the following ingredients, and they need to all be at room temperature. You need a half a cup of melted butter, 1 cup of flour, 1 cup of sugar, 2 tablespoons of baking powder, 1/4 teaspoon of salt, 2/3 cup of milk. I would recommend a heavy cream myself because it creates a different texture, but you can just use regular milk or evaporated milk, whatever you have handy. Don't use the nonstick. No, it doesn't do this. It really doesn't do justice. You need 1 egg, 1 large egg, and then that is for the batter, what I just gave you, the butter, the flour, sugar, baking powder, salt, milk, and egg. All of that is for the batter. Your filling, you're going to need about 3.5 to 4 cups of diced peaches, and you need to drain them, and I would say drain them on, you know, paper towels. 28 ounces, you could measure that, 1 cup, which is 3.5 to 4 cups of peaches, and then 1 cup of sugar and 1 teaspoon of cinnamon, 1/2 teaspoon of nutmeg. And that's grated, fresh grated nutmeg really has a flavor punch that's just fabulous. This is how easy it is. Your flour, your sugar, your baking powder and salt, you mix that all together. Now, your butter, you can melt that and then just put it right in a 9 by 13 inch pan, like I mentioned. And then your milk and egg, you beat that together and you add that in to your flour mixture and mix it well. And then what you do, you pour that into your 9 by 13 pan. I told you this was easy. Then your peaches, your sugar and spices, you mix all of those together and you put that over the top of the batter. Don't stir. You don't do any stirring. You just put the peaches right on top of the batter. And you're going to bake it at 350 degrees for 35 to 40 minutes. What happens is the batter comes to the top, creating that crusty cobbler, and it will be golden brown, and it's delicious served once it's done with ice cream. Mm-hmm. Vanilla ice cream is best. Well, whatever your preference for ice cream is. But this is so easy to make. And, oh, does it smell good when it's baking? I think I would want to add just a touch of vanilla. That's me. But remember, these spices, If you want to alter them or if there are certain things you would like to add, you could also put into here, put into the peach mixture. You could add some sliced almonds if you wanted. That would give it a little bit of a crunch. There's just so many things you can try that would make this a little bit different. But try the basic recipe first, a peach cobbler. Oh, very, very good. And, of course, you could make this with fresh peaches when the peaches come out in season, which is going to be in a few months. But, hey, try this with the canned peaches. It'll really make those cool temperatures. Well, they won't bother you at all. Mm-mm. They will just be what they are, cool temperatures. Donna Sebo here, 253-582-5597. A little bit of history that is coming forth more and more about the Mayan people. And this is because of archaeology. We have speculated for so many generations about who these people were, why certain areas were abandoned. We come up with all kinds of stuff. And in 2012, there was a forest. It's called the Chattahoochee National Forest. And they're finding all kinds of things into it. But apparently, there have been some edicts put into place relative to this national forest because it is loaded with all kinds of artifacts and they don't want them to be bothered. And they have found in the archaeological research that they've been doing, they have found agricultural practices done by the Mayans that were so sophisticated. They've actually found dams. We all know about the ceremonial environments. We've seen those in many programs. Terracing, like the Chinese have done and the Asian people have done for thousands of years. Well, the Mayans have used the same kind of technique. Rock foundations. The Chinese, when they came into an environment, if they ended up settling, it was quite common for them to build walls, to have foundations of rock. The Chinese people historically were just way ahead of the Europeans. We were in the Dark Ages, and these people were just creating masterpieces of beauty. And the creativity and skill sets were just phenomenal. And that is something that we are just learning more and more about. And there is speculation that the Chinese actually had come to North America a long time before Columbus ever got here. And they are finding remnants of the Chinese having visited, we know about it in South America, but they actually had a fleet in the 1400s that traveled around the world. I think so many times people feel that the ancestors of the past were really a bunch of, you know, illiterates that could never have dared to travel. But we had seamanship that's been demonstrated in so many ways, including the Vikings, that we know now they were here in the United States, what we call the United States today, North America, and they probably even got to South America. But one of the things that they are finding is that the Mayans were traders, and they actually are finding artifacts in Georgia. Yes, in Georgia, the state of Georgia. And the Mayan people ended up going into the southeastern part of the United States. They have found 300 structures. They've radiocarbon dated the structures. That, I mean, just absolutely amazing things that we're finding. And do you know that the Creek Indians here in the United States had the same kind of symbols as the Mayans had? Mm-hmm. So there was some kind of communication a long, long time ago, and various points of information that are shared, we're going to realize eventually how very, very small, relatively speaking, this world really is, in that people, they traveled. They traded. There were all kinds of things that were going on that we finally are beginning to become aware of. I think it's fascinating. I think we live in a very exciting period because history books are being rewritten, or they should be. And it's going to take a bit of time, but what we are finding out is exciting. We are finding out so much more about Egypt. We're finding out that the Egyptians were not slaves, that they actually worked, you know, and were paid with beer and meat and, you know, just they were given compensation for working. And because most of the workers were farmers or in the agricultural environment during the months when they didn't have that work to do, they would come in and they would work on the pyramids and on other structures so that they would be gainfully employed. Who doesn't do that today? Same thing. We'll do whatever we have to do so that we can take care of our homes, our families, and our lives and live comfortably. So they did the same thing. They just did it a little differently than we did. I think that we are very, very fortunate to be able to have all of the individuals doing the research as they are doing it. And it is just an absolute delight. One of the things I wanted to mention, because we are getting closer and closer to phase three here in the state of Washington, we have a love of travel. Americans love to travel, and other countries love having us come in because we bring in all of those greenbacks. But the truth is, with all of the restrictions that we've had and the industries relative to travel, whether it's a hotel, planes, transportation, restaurants, you name it, they've all had this horrific impact that has literally destroyed millions of jobs. And we're going to get back on track again. And like I said a moment ago, Alaskans, boy, they're on the go. They're moving. They're going in and out of different parts of Alaska. They're flying and they're saying, this is what we're going to do. I was talking with a friend just yesterday who was on a plane, went to Las Vegas in the morning, turned around, came home that evening. No problems at all. And this is, we're getting back. We're getting back into the flow. And this is something that I think is so important, because I like the quote by Mark Twain where he said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. It really is. Because when you are able to see other cultures, other environments, you find that your world opens up. Your world opens up in a very, very significant way. And it makes you, alerts you, to the diversity that we have the pleasure of being able to experience, and I think history. And when we study history, we can learn a lot from that history so that we can be more empowered in today's world and hopefully not repeat the mistakes of our ancestors. One of the things that has happened, because there's not so many planes flying and there's not so many cars out driving about, although you wouldn't know that today. Here in the Seattle area, it's bumper to bumper traffic almost every day at certain times. Not quite as bad as it was before the coronavirus hit, but it is getting close. It is really amazing. People are just really anxious to be out and about. That comes with spring. Well, one of the things that I found out about history, especially with plane flights, and the America's first transatlantic flight was in 1939. And the only times that we are slowed down from traveling to different parts of the world. I was talking with someone earlier today. They had been to Africa. They've gone to Africa multiple times. I talked with someone else, and they've been to Ireland, Scotland, Australia. They can hardly wait until they can get on a plane and go visit some other places. Well, in 1972, the post-World War II boom in travel really started getting going. And that was because here in the United States, incomes went up. There were better planes. It was more comfortable flying and overseas travel. People still did a great deal of it by boat. They would take boats, but boy, taking a plane, whoo, you get there in literally no time at all. Just fabulous. And in 1985, the percentage of Americans traveling overseas topped 5% for the very first time, and the share of Americans traveling to Africa, Asia, the Middle East, and Oceania rose 44% from 1984. It was that big a jump just in 1 year. And then in 2001, there was a huge loss. Why? Yes, you figured it out. 9/11. I was in Alaska when that happened, and it was really something. People couldn't get out. And when I talked to individuals that experienced it, they said the hotels were packed, restaurants were packed, people could not even leave. And by 2000, and well, let me just give this stat. The airline industry in 2001, due to 9/11, lost over $7 billion. And they didn't have the long spiel that we have had this past year. They had a period of months, but that much money was lost. And by 2002, annual U.S. overseas travel dropped 13% from its previous peak prior to 9/11, and it didn't recover until 2004. Now, that was because of those circumstances. People just did not want to travel from America overseas. They felt very vulnerable. In 2008, we had the Great Recession. There was a 7-year downturn in the annual U.S. overseas travel volume. Airlines lost $10.4 billion globally on business and leisure travel. It just tanked. 2018, overseas travel, people were everywhere. They were just going. The job opportunities that were available went from a particular level to 1.14 million jobs. That was triple the amount of the jobs that were held in the leisure and hospitality industry. And, you know, it's plunging because of what happened in the latter part of 2019 and 2020. Jeez. Hardly anybody travels. And, of course, the countries are in lockdown. Many of them are not allowing people in. And it's just been amazing. So for the airline industry to have weathered as many challenges as they have since 2001, and that doesn't give any reference to those previously, but just think, since 2001, we've had multiple scenarios where those industries and the hospitality and the leisure industries have been threatened big time. So we'll come out of this, and I think that there's going to be a real period of adjustment so that it comes back to where people are feeling comfortable again flying. But I think, again, that there's new innovations and technologies that are becoming available, so people will feel a lot safer flying. Yes. So we are in for some exciting things. Do check out my email newsletter and listen to John Denver song. That we fly higher and higher. Anyway, remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna Sebo, and I will be in studio tomorrow evening. I look forward to spending time with you, and we're going to be talking old books and how to renovate them. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Be well. We'll be talking tomorrow. Bye for now.
Been listening to the Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.